This week, Brother Andy Albright explores the idea of a world without the concept of justice. One of the four cardinal virtues stripped away, is justice more important than the other virtues? Can it exist without the others? What are the dangers of a society without the concept of justice, and how important is it to Freemasonry? Then, an all-new Masonic Mythbusters with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day. Is there a connection between the Advent and Mithraism? Does the popular memes that float around the internet have it right? In this particular segment of Masonic Mythbusters, Worshipful Brother Day tackles the very question of the Mithraic candles and the Advent candles. You'll want to stay tuned for this one. And finally, we'll wrap it up with a concept brought by the poetry of William Blake about the creative process. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 572. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners for assisting with the production of this podcast. It's no small endeavor, and we've been doing it since July of 2011. And with your help, we are the most downloaded Masonic podcast in the world, with over 2.5 million listeners. And it's all thanks to you that we've been able to spread the light of Freemasonry. And as Albert Mackey would have said, it's kindred sciences in a responsible, non-sensational, and accurate way. If you want to learn more about how you can assist this podcast, you can head on over to wcypodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see your options. We've also got a shop and a bookstore that links through Amazon with affiliate sales, where you get a book, the author gets a sale, and the show gets a few pennies from each sale. All of that is very much appreciated. In the news, again, I want to thank everybody out there who has been reaching out and letting me know that, you know, they've been keeping my family in their prayers and whatnot. I think all of that is working well. My mom is doing better, so I really appreciate all of your thoughts and well wishes. One step at a time, day to day, you know, things get better and better. And we just try to stay positive with all of those things. So thank you so very much. On the 13th of December, I'll be doing Freemasonry, A History of Mystery for Eau Claire Lodge, number 112 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I think I'm saying that right. I'm probably not, but I'm going to be up there. And we're going to do that particular presentation. Where did we come from, really? What is the purpose of our existence as Freemasons? What is the divine revelation of our ritual? So in this keynote address, we're going to explore all these things. And by the end, you'll be ready to work with your lodge and change the world. I hope to see you there. And then, of course, after Christmas, I'll be doing the Masonic pub crawl, I believe, in Warsaw, Indiana, again, the 27th of December. More on that to follow as we get closer to that date. I want to tell everybody, keep an eye out in the mail. We're going to be sending our annual Christmas card out to all of our supporters of the show. And I want to just say thank you in advance. It is important to be able to wish you all the best in the coming year, the changeover to 2023. Wow, sounds so futuristic. And yet, here we are, right on the precipice. So I am hoping to get those cards out to you all here in the coming weeks. And I just want to say thank you again. So on November 19th, we had the second annual Double Eagle Con at the Valley of Chicago Scottish Rite. And we had a number of speakers come in from all around. And we had one speaker come in who I was really excited about. I was really excited about all of them, but one in particular was pretty cool, and I really wanted to know more about some of his work. And this was Brother Andy Albright. Now, he's a 32nd degree KCCH from the Valley of Charleston, South Carolina. And in the lead-up to the event, we had dinner together. It was the night before. And Brother Andy had mentioned he had a presentation that he delivered called And Justice for Some, which sounded interesting to me because, as you all know, I have a interest in the idea of, in Freemasonry, the concept of justice as being on the level in all aspects of the world. And I think Masonry is a preeminent organization that is poised to demonstrate this, or has demonstrated this, at least, in some respect, symbolically. And so a week after the event, Brother Andy sent me the paper and he said, hey, you expressed some interest in this. I read it. I liked it. So I asked him, I said, hey, Brother Andy, can I please read this on the show? And he said, go for it. So I wanted to read that for you right now. And this is called Then Justice for Some by Brother Andy Albright, 32nd Degree, KCCH, Valley of Charleston, South Carolina. Situated in downtown Charleston, South Carolina, are some of the best examples of middle and late colonial era architecture in the southern United States. The famous Rainbow Row is a series of homes that have been restored and rebuilt over the many years of their existence, dating back to the middle to late 18th century. Among the building of interest to Scottish Rite Masons would be the famous Shepherd's Tavern. Although the tavern no longer exists, historical markers can be found at the current structure. One little known area of Charleston contains a very unique arrangement of buildings called the Four Corners of Law. On one corner, St. Michael's Episcopal Church with its iconic steeple. On another corner, Charleston City Hall. Another, Charleston County Courthouse. And the last, the United States Post Office and Federal Courthouse. At this one intersection, a person can stand amidst the most important institutions for the preservation of spiritual and social law and mercy, the basic fundamentals of justice, of the laws of God and man. We, as a civil society, have every expectation to rely on each one of these four institutions to manage our government and church in accordance with the law. The four cardinal virtues, like these four buildings, are situated on the four corners of a square, providing mankind with the base on which we erect our spiritual edifice. Remove one of the corners, and the structure will fail. If one corner is not square, the entire building will not pass the level and plumb. The close examination of justice will reveal to the inquirer how the remaining cardinal virtues depend on the preservation of justice. Temperance remains a viable virtue, as we know that we will face a just reaction to the failure to avoid indulging in excessive and licentious behavior. The suffering of the soul, should we fail to guard it against attack, installs in us a necessary reinforcement of the virtue of fortitude, and that the hand of justice will sooner or later be laid on our attackers. The government of our conduct can be held in check by the potential of justified repercussions when we fail to act with prudence. Justice should have no name, no identity, no political association, and no expectation of favoritism. Justice must remain the chaste daughter of liberty and freedom, committed to none and a beneficent friend to all. Always justice has to be the cement foundation of society, able to support the weight of all else constructed. All men should gaze upon her with hope and despair, joy and terror, knowing that all her actions must neither be good or evil, but just and righteous. As an American people, we conduct our lives under the protection of justice, under the law, as a democratic right. Suppose, however, the conduct of our courts and those charged with administering the law were no longer bound by democratic rights. Let's presume that justice was no longer a right freely given to all, but purchased by means of the social status of some as a commodity. Justice no longer becomes the cement of society. She yields to her vile twin, injustice, who rules on the shifting sands of a desert, always changing with the winds of the day, with no sense of consistency. Injustice makes herself loyal to no one, darkly personified by the immorality of a woman who makes herself available to any willing to sacrifice their soul. The behavior of injustice reverberates through civil society, bringing destruction to the foundations of freedom and liberty. People living under the protection of a constitutional government expect to conduct their lives with autonomy. If the democratic right to justice were removed, would people still enjoy that autonomy? I would venture to say that the enjoyment of autonomy would be based on social status. The common man would no longer have the benefit of making his own choices and become compelled by force to enact the will of others in prominent positions of authority. While we might consider such a travesty to be inconceivable, we must remember we are not too far removed from the history of Europe and the days when the Church of Rome dictated to all how their lives should submit to the canonical tyranny of the Pope. What about in our modern times? Conceive in your mind a life where your educational opportunities were dictated to you, what labors you will perform, and where you must reside. Without justice protecting our autonomy, what you have conceived in your mind would be your reality. The stability of society would be absent. The threat of an uprising by the oppressed would cause those in power to be on a constant vigilance, always influenced by rumors and unfounded speculations. Lies would become fact so that unjust actions could be justified for the preservation of despotism. Have we forgotten the lessons of the Salem witch trials and the horrors inflicted on innocent men and women due to little more than a hint of wrongdoing? Revenge usurps justice, falsehoods snuff out truth, and none would be safe. The speed of our modern communication abilities could destabilize society in just moments, and in the hands of a despot becomes a formidable weapon that can crush the cement of society into nothing more than pebbles. When the despot and the tyrant are free from the firm hand of justice, what hope would the people governed have for a stable and peaceful country? Justice is the manifestation of the theories of deontological ethics, or a system of ethics where rules and moral duties determine the rightness of an action, not the outcome. If we remove justice from her duties, then we would be faced with a terror of consequentialism, the theory that the morality of an action is justified by the outcome. The end justifies the means. When the rule of law is removed as the guide of right judgments, rash and impulsive actions will become the new guide, serving only the will of self-appointed masters, fulfilling their deformed perceptions of what is the greater good. Licentious and vicious actions are no longer seen as unjust, if the end result satisfied desires of despots and tyrants. The working class will no doubt feel the brunt of unethical actions when they are judged as unworthy to receive mercy due to their economic and educational status. Once removed from her place of prominence in society, justice does not easily return to her rightful throne. A tyrant and despot, having indulged in their unquenchable lust for power, will not quietly lay down their scepter of cruelty. The tyrant will summon his forces to put down any rebellion with no concern of life and property. I don't mean to suggest that these forces will be armed men in conflict. The wealth of a tyrant is alluring temptation to the poor and suffering, and comfort and ease will not easily be turned away. Mental manipulation by means of false reports can incite the weak minds of fanatics into carrying out the will of despots. A tyrant and despot will follow after the counsel of Sun Tzu, who said the smartest general can win a battle without ever fighting. The virtue of veracity would be sacrificed on the altar of lies to appease the gods of deceit. Justice will sooner or later have her say, although many will not witness such judgments. Freemasons across the world are charged to never deviate from the minutest principle of justice. The devastation of allowing justice to be compromised is unimaginable to us. Do we, the craft, believe that we would remain unscathed if justice fails? The rights of men to gather together under the banner of a fraternal organization would most certainly be called into question when ignorance prevails and unjust actions are taken to prevent our assemblies. None can escape the unfairness of rules and laws created to disperse those whom the despot fear. Confidentiality of private fraternities would cease to exist, and the privacy expectations of the people would suffer. The rights of mankind to gather together and worship according to their faith is a fundamental principle closely guarded by justice. But tyrants across the course of human history have always challenged this right. The self-righteous edicts of tyrants are not concerned with the liberty and freedoms of those under their rule. Our laws are established with the intent of ensuing protection under the law regardless of a person's educational level, economic standing, or social status. Absent of justice, the law would receive her sight and become focused only on the will of those who exert influence over the courts. Malfeasance takes the role of justice, and the judgments handed down would cripple society. No one would have a reasonable expectation of protection of the law against the will of despots, and the common people would be in fear of the harm that would be inflicted on them. The courtroom, no longer bound by the civility of the law, ceasing to have any measure of respect for individuals, would issue orders based on the biased opinions of the judge without regard to the rights of a person. Rulings would not be to support the rights of an individual, but to serve the means of promoting the agenda of tyrants. Masonry teaches us that justice in great measure will distinguish the real good man. The preservation of justice is not as simple as we would hope, and the necessity for the preservation of civil society can never be overstated. I have only offered to you brief examples of the calamities that could befall humanity if justice becomes compromised. Freemasons must always be vigilant to see justice rule from her court and her honor always remain intact. Andy Albright, 32nd Degree, KCCH, Valley of Charleston, South Carolina. This was a great piece that really stayed unbiased. For me, the piece read very benign of any political ideology. It spoke to the importance of the idea of justice as being upheld by civil society and just how much of a threat that mere existence would cause a person if it were compromised, justice that is. For our Craftsman Plus, I'd love to know of any legal case that you found within the scope of, you know, the United States or somewhere else, or famous cases throughout history where justice prevailed. When we think about things like the Salem witch trials, which were mentioned, or perhaps where justice failed throughout history. Now, next up, let's get into the Masonic Mythbusters with worshipful brother Patrick Day in the first of a series of holiday season or Christmas-themed Masonic and occult myth-busting. Let's check it out.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
Last year, I did a single sort of overarching piece addressing whether the Christians stole Christmas from the pagans. To reiterate, yes, kind of, but also no, not really. It's always way more complicated than just that. Christians were largely Roman, so they celebrated the Mass of Christ in the only cultural style they knew, Roman style. How does one steal their own culture? It is obviously a neo-pagan revival that drives these sort of statements, and there are obviously many more examples. So I want to do a few short pieces for each week of Christmas, much shorter than is my usual verbose style. Today I want to talk about so-called Mithras candles. You may have seen some meme floating around on your social media feeds, probably from a neo-pagan friend, in which it says that Advent candles are actually Mithras candles. No. What are Mithras candles? So I've spent a lot of time researching the cults of Mithras and the Roman Empire, and I am completely unaware of any instance in which candles were particularly important. I mean, obviously they needed candles as Mithraea, which would be the meeting halls of the Mithraic cults, were usually underground, typically in a basement or substructure of a building. Even the few examples of Mithraea built above ground, they still had no windows. They're supposed to resemble caves, so yeah, they would need candles, or possibly lanterns, or lamps, or pyres, or possibly more likely would have been torches, as these are significant in Mithraic imagery and art. Namely, two unique Mithraic characters, Kaltes and Kaltopates, the torchbearers. One has a torch that is raised and the other has a torch that is lowered, has its own important symbolism in the cult and astrological significance. But I digress. So what? They needed artificial light in their halls. It doesn't mean candles were proprietary to the Mithraic cults. So let's do a little brief history of candles and look at what qualifies as a candle and see if it fits this meme as presented. Candles might be technically defined as a length of combustible material that is thickly coated in a solid, fatty, or waxy substance to slow the combustion for an extended period of time. Here in Colorado, there's an old tradition of cowboy torches, also called witches' candles. I don't know why. It's dried mullein stalks that have been coated in tallow or wax and then set ablaze. Some of the earliest known candles, technically candles, were about 5,000 years ago. Early centuries of Old Kingdom Egypt. They were basically dried reeds that are soaked or dipped into animal fat. Tallow candles would very shortly replace these proto-candles, as tallow is really just rendered animal fat. The first wax candles were made of beeswax. The first ones recorded are circa 1st century BCE as being used in the Zhen Dynasty of China. Beeswax candles do not appear or enter Europe until about the 6th or 7th centuries, possibly as early as the 5th century, but certainly no earlier or later. Beeswax candles would have been more favorable as they burn cleaner, longer, and they don't smell as bad as tallow candles. Ever smelt burnt animal fat? Like when you burn your bacon? Yeah, imagine being in a windowless room with a bunch of stinky men in ancient Rome with the smell of burnt pork belly fat pervading the place. Depending on the opulence of the various Mithraic cults, if they use small sources of light, like candles, they probably would have favored oil lamps than tallow candles. Tallow candles are complicated. If you've ever seen the film The Witch by Robert Eggers, you'll notice they do these funny things with their candles hanging one over another at different angles. This was an old technique of lengthening the burn time on tallow candles because they burn pretty fast. Oil lamps are cleaner and they smell nice. It's kind of like a candle. You basically have a hemp wick in some oil and then you ignite the wick. The oil reserves prevent the wick from burning too quickly and the oil seeps up the wick to combust. Candles just have solid reserves, which then melt and the molten wax or fat seeps up the wick to combust. Oil lamps seem the most likely to have been used in the Mithraic cults as olive oil was in plentiful supplies throughout the Roman trade routes. After the collapse of the Roman Empire in the 5th century, switching to tallow and then beeswax candles became more practical. This is likely how beeswax came to be used in Northern European candles. They were very quickly adopted for ecclesiastical purposes and have remained as such since. Now, Advent candles are a late tradition in Christianity. The concept of the Advent wreath may have developed as early as the 16th century, but it was in the early 19th century that they were popularized in Germany. Johann Heinrich Wickern is likely the originator of the Advent wreath. He was a Protestant pastor working with poor children in Hamburg. In 1839, he is said to have gotten fed up with the children asking if Christmas had arrived yet. So he took a cartwheel and put 20 red candles and 5 white candles on them. Each day, a new candle was lit in succession, with the white ones being lit on Sundays until all candles were lit, marking Christmas. Yay! The concept quickly spread, mostly with 5 white candles lit on successive Sundays, or some variation thereof. Yeah, some German pastor wanting to help poor kids count the days until Christmas totally stole the idea of candles from some mystery religion he likely never heard of. So, where did this whole idea of Mithras candles come from? As far as I can discern, the term Mithras candle is not even used prior to 2018 or 2019. That is when a Pennsylvanian candle company called Mithras Candles was formed. They specialize in beeswax candles. Their website states the following, quote, "The ancient god Mithras was of Persian Zoroastrian origin, a protector of truth and a god of illumination, who was later incorporated into a mystery cult in ancient Rome. It is thought that beeswax candles first made an appearance in the West during Roman Mithraic mystery rituals. One Mithraic symbol involves a lion, the trial of Leo, with a bee in its mouth, which we have adopted." End quote. If you know anything about the cults of Mithras, this is all kind of, but also no, not really. It's the grade of Leo, or the degree of Leo, but it's not a trial. And it was likely the fourth grade. No depictions of symbols related to the Leo grade have been found depicting a lion with a bee in its mouth, at least as far as I have read in the various CIMRM. The image this company uses is taken directly from Thomas Hyde's De Vitae Religione Pisarium, or On the Old Persian Religion, published in 1700, second edition would be 1760. Actually, now that I think about it, I'm not even sure anyone has ever published finding any wax, much less candles, in any Mithraeum ever. Like, I'm sure they have found some wax or tallow, but I don't know if anyone has ever published on it. Certainly not in English. It's doubtful, in my opinion, this company's founders actually knew much of anything about Mithraism, much less understood any of it, and likely just found some cool 18th century engraving and thought, this must be Mithraic. Like many things today, someone learned something, applied it backwards in a different context, and then just ran with it. Some company 3 years ago created a cute narrative to suit their commercial enterprise, and somehow that became a fact that has been circulating on the internet since. It's kind of annoying.
All right. What a fantastic episode of this. I'm really looking forward to the next three. I think you guys are going to love them. This last one was great just because it really takes on this thing that I think is just... maybe the term disease is, like, a little too aggressive, but the sort of pop culture meme esotericist like knowledge nugget drop, you know, on Facebook is just a disease. Everything is out of context. Everything kind of is half the story. It's never quite correct. And honestly, my favorite part about this particular segment was when Patrick said the first use of the word Mithraic in this context was a company that started just a few years ago. And so that is pretty funny. And for this one company who has not necessarily done the greatest research on this, we get quote-unquote facts put onto a meme and spread all over Facebook. And in occult Facebook groups, even Masonic groups where these things appear. It's just kind of a shame. But anyway, our thanks goes out to Worshipful Brother Dave for putting these together for us. No small endeavor indeed. And of course, we are all the wiser having listened to these awesome segments. So thank you once more, Brother Patrick. Speaking of Brother Patrick, he's got a wonderful article in the latest Rocky Mountain magazine. He has done a great service to Freemasonry. And we have actually read pieces about the Dionysian architects or the Dionysian artists within this podcast in the past and have published on the Midnight Freemasons. And really what those posts entail are the tales of what we know from specific authors, Masonic and occult alike, and staying within just their lens, what can we show? of these groups, the Dionysian architects. Well, as usual, Brother Patrick Day went above and beyond with his most recent piece, where he has actually taken all of those sources and then traced them back to their sources. And he does a phenomenal job in somewhat debunking the traditional notion of what the Dionysian architects even were. Was Manly P. Hall full of it? Probably. And I think it was a great article he put together. He really leaves no stone unturned, so there's really nowhere to go. He leads you from start to finish, doesn't let you stray off the path, really takes you through the entire history of this idea. A fantastic article called The Dionysian Artists, or Architects, I think, and it's in the latest Rocky Mountain Mason magazine, which I just got in the mail a couple of days ago. So please be sure to check out that excellent publication, which I believe is kind of going to be doubling down, as they say. There's going to be some new issues that are released very soon. I'll have a link back to where you can subscribe to that great publication. And there is a podcast as well, hosted by Brother Ben Williams, the editor-in-chief. Today we're going to do our contemplative exercise. We're going to use a card from the William Blake Tarot by Ed Byrne. And, of course, on the cover, it's got that famous Urizen who is applying the compasses. The full title of this deck is actually the William Blake Tarot of the Creative Imagination, which I think is really important. As I have told you all in the past, I've gotten some pushback on this, mostly from folks who really are not that they're not interested in, but that they feel there is too much of a negative connotation within tarot to be mentioned within a Masonic context. And yet, you know, tarot is something that is not any different than the same thing we're doing with working tools. We look at working tools, how does that apply to my life? We look at this card, which means this, how does that apply to my life? That's all it's doing. And so I submit that, again, I will tell you that, as I always have, the tarot has nothing to do with Freemasonry. It is simply a contemplative exercise. And as Masons, we are called to be contemplative. In fact, Freemasonry is a contemplative art in which we are called to utilize our quote-unquote working tools, which are elements of our psyche, to change our conscious minds and how we operate, to become a better man. And so, with that, I'd love to pick one random card from the tarot of William Blake. Now, William Blake did not create a tarot deck. Ed Byrne did. And it's based on the artworks of William Blake. So these are it's a nice deck. The cards are kind of oversized. They are gold-edged cards. Pages, if you want to call them that, right? A tarot is a book. Tarot is a book, and it has an ISBN and is referred to as a book. But I'm just going to go ahead and give these cards a shuffle. Some people ask, hey, do you have a specific way you shuffle? Do you charge your cards and do all these things? I do some things with that stuff, but let's be honest and just say, hey, really, it kind of doesn't matter, right? Anybody can just go grab a $5 deck of tarot cards or even your own playing deck of cards, and you can grab any card and see what that card means for you. And when I say, oh, you can just grab a plain deck of playing cards, what does that mean? Well, a playing card deck is the same thing as a tarot deck with the page and the major arcana removed. It is a modern adaptation of the original Tarocchi deck, which was a game, not some conjurer's tool or anything like that. And that's important to understand. Tarot gets this terrible reputation from ghost shows and all of this other goofy stuff. But there's nothing about it that is spooky. It's just like I've said this time and time again, it's a psychological Rorschach. I'm going to go ahead and just, after I've shuffled now, I'm going to pick one card. I'll flip it over and see what we get. I have received a card that is called the Angel of Poetry. It says, angels stand round my spirit. That is coming from William Blake himself. But I got the card inversed. So we need to do a couple things first of all. Before we talk about what this card means and think about what it could mean for us, we need to understand what is the Angel of Poetry, because this doesn't fit into the standard realm of the deck, per se. Like, we're used to pentacles, wands, swords, and cups. So what's what here? He makes the suits are painting, science, music, and poetry. And so poetry here is the expression of eternal truth. To speak from prophetic inspiration, a path of individuality and revelation. Now, this is really interesting because it takes a little bit of each of the different suits traditionally in tarot, pulls those attributes out, and almost rearranges them to put them in these new categories. So let's see what the card means as the angel of poetry, according to Ed Byrne, who put this one together. So the angel of poetry is essentially it's like the squire card or the page card of the suit of poetry. And it says, burst of imagination that requires action, feeling aroused by creative power, profound inner realization, communion with the spirit, freeing the creative forces within yourself, getting a glimpse of what is possible if you don't hold back, opening yourself to new experiences, to spontaneity and passion for truth, daring to be great. So right away, the way I read this is almost as if this is kind of like a wands card, dealing with manifestation and creativity. There's a little bit of that divine feminine force coming in here. So this card doesn't actually have anything to mean when it is inversed. They have chosen to not use a reverse value. So, good news or bad news, doesn't matter. We can flip the card back around to the upright position and read what it says. It says, in the creative process, imaginative insights are transforming your work, making it into a receptacle of divine truth and spiritual artistry. Wow. So what this card could possibly mean for us is obvious in the way that we would look at our creative passions. Under the guise of masonry, what does this mean? What if this is telling us that we're on the verge of a cool project in Lodge? What if we're creating painting for the lodge? What if we're creating a new trestle board for the lodge? What if we want to create a new program for the lodge? What if we have a burning desire to create some new sort of visualization or process for our lodges to utilize, whether that be a membership process, a process of introducing concepts and ideas to our entered apprentices, fellows of the craft, and master masons? Or perhaps this is a new way of putting on the degree work. Maybe you're in the midst of transforming into a TO lodge or something along those lines. What this card can tell us is that we should embrace those creative bursts. For me, this is relevant, and I'll just say this, I'll put it in the group as well when we have a discussion of the Craftsman Plus group. For me, this comes down to the idea of a lot of my creative endeavors as of late have been centered around, of course, the leather work that I do. But also, as of late, I've had a really hard time with writing. I used to write lots of cool stuff all the time for Midnight Freemasons, and then I slowly transformed my writing into a more op-ed style where I take on some tougher, more difficult topics that, you know, I get on my soapbox. If you know me, that's kind of where I hang my hat as of late. But recently, I had two really inspiring and interesting things that I just want to research and write about. And for me, this card is telling me, do it, don't wait, go for it. So if I wake up from a dream or something and I can't sleep at night, I'm going to start writing. I'm just going to go for it. There are consequences for that too, right? We got to manage our 24-inch gauge. But what I'm hoping for the listeners out there is that for all of us, maybe if you have been thinking about something in the creative forum where you want to create something or you're thinking about doing it, this is the go-ahead to say, yeah, do it. Follow that creative fire. It's interesting to note also like the kind of esoteric philosophy about the idea of creation, that God is called to create by some intrinsic nature of its own calling and design. And that this creative force necessarily is imbued within mankind as well, being of divine origins ourselves. So to create is intrinsic to mankind as well, as a trait that has been passed from parent to child. That's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Come back next week for another Masonic Mythbuster segment. We're going to run them each week and up until Christmas, and even if we have to have a Christmas episode to get that last one in there, then I guess we're going to do it. Usually we go dark for the last 2 weeks of the year, but we may not. We'll see how it goes. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and our legacy partners for all that they're doing to bring this program to you. I'll hope to see you at either Eau Claire or Eau Claire, I don't know how to say that, Lodge up in Wisconsin, or perhaps in Indiana, or maybe somewhere else in 2023 in the future. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
That's it. Okay, you're up.